now, why is the road from Carrickgart... Sorry, I'm struggling to speak this week. I'm tongue-tied. Why is the road from Carrickgart Garda Barracks closed when it's only half a mile of road from Duntally to the main N56 road that's actually closed? I took such a detour yesterday trying to get home only to realise there was no need for it at all. The road should only be closed from Duntally and divert there. I think someone from the council needs to have a look at that and see the awful, unnecessary detour they're putting on people. I was hoping they were going to cut the weeds hanging onto the dangerous bends at Lacquer Bridge, but unfortunately not. I don't know how all of this works. But if you were going from Carrickgart to Creasley, you can't go on that road. And the signs, I did see one of these signs actually, it says local access only. So I presumed, I drove through, I presumed that means that if you know where you're going and you're not following a sat-nav or what have you, you would know what to do. So I don't know the reasons for that. I imagine it's that to divert traffic travelling from Carrickgart to Creasley because that part of the road is closed. That's the only reason I can imagine it to be the case. Local traffic is permitted still. I was in a shopping centre car park one day and I was shocked to see a Garda car sitting in a disabled space while one of them went to the shop. I sat watching for quite a while before they came out and I assure you they were neither disabled or in a hurry. Car parks, private car parks are different than some people. Was that a mother and child space or what have you? I don't know. It's not a good look anyway. There's no need for anyone to use disabled spots. I see ones that have the badge belonging to their mum or dad and they haven't got their parents with them but still use the spot just because they have the badge. It's not hard for people to walk a wee bit. And another one, I went into hospital to see my friend that drove both car parks, could not get parked. It was 2:30 and lots of cars were doing the same. I never checked car parks over the road was the same. Sorry, I even checked car park over the road was the same, so I had to go home. I didn't see my friend. I did mention that too in my conversation with Thomas, that there are people also abusing the badges. Another caller says, cars who park in disabled parking spaces should be clamped on the spot. €1,000 release fee. Go to the new Aldi on the Neil T. Blaney Road any Saturday evening from 7 p.m. and look and watch how many cars park in the disabled space for convenience and space around fancy cars. It's ridiculous. Shops should have the disabled parking spaces monitored and clamped as soon as people walk away from the car. This has to be monitored and people should be fined heavily. They won't park again in these spots, says that listener. Letterkenny is a disgrace with curbs for anyone with a wheelchair. Never mind parking. The town itself is a disgrace for everyone in a wheelchair. I only have a child's pushchair and I can't imagine. I don't know how people in wheelchairs manage. And there was an interesting experiment not so long ago whereby, you know, people in position of power, councillors, etc., were invited to try and get around a town in a wheelchair. I think Donegal Town was certainly one of them at the time. And all of a sudden, those cracks in the pavement that catch the wheels, even the dropped curves where there's still like over an inch, it's not actually a truly dropped curb, all that kind of stuff, you only read sandwich boards. You kind of only realise it, I'm told, when you're sitting in a wheelchair and trying to get about the place. So you're quite right there. It has been proven. And there also was a study recently on disability access. I think Dunloe was certainly one of the towns that featured where... There were assessments of how accessible certain places are, you know, high curbs, steps and all that kind of stuff. How can people who've just had a hip done and can't walk cope if they don't have a disabled badge? I don't know what the story is there. At the end of the day, they're not permanently disabled. There is a process. I don't know how soon after the hip operation. I think you are advised to walk on it nowadays. Greg, what's the story with revenue and pensions? My sister got a letter a few weeks ago to say she owed the money, even though she retired 2 years ago. I myself was told I was owed money, but had to do a tax return, which I wouldn't have a clue how to do. Surely they already have all my information. It's 2025. How does such a thing happen? In terms of owing money, there's an issue with pensions, and we might do something on this a little later on. It's if you get a state pension and you have a private pension, I believe the private pension is taxable potentially, and that's where people are being caught out. In terms of having overpaid tax, you could use one of those tax rebate companies. They'll take a percentage from you, I don't know what it is, and they do all that for you. Maybe that's an option. So half a loaf's better than no bread at all. Now, it's not half of the money they take, but maybe that's the way to do it. Driving along the dual carriageway, we all know where that is because there's only one, I noticed lots of yellow ragwort plants. It's poisonous to animals. It's illegal to have on farmland. If it spreads to farm lands, they can be prosecuted. The issue was recently highlighted of ragwort growing outside Leinster House and it was removed immediately. Why is nothing else done about it on dual carriageways? This used to be a role for Gardaí. Do you remember, or maybe you don't, but you would get, you know, local Gardaí going into farmers' fields and highlighting stuff like ragwort plants that shouldn't be there. They actually literally did that. Maybe you've got a memory of that, 086 60 25,000. But yep, that's public property. Why is it there? Greg, I saw an ad for an Oasis ticket last night. One ticket, €600, and that is the legitimate cost. Who's paying these prices for one concert ticket? I don't know. But maybe they're not going on holidays this year. Maybe Oasis is just the biggest band they've ever followed. Maybe it brings back all the memories of their youth, and maybe, just maybe, they travel up and down and say, well, I'm not paying £250 for a hotel, so that means it's £350. And, you know, I work really hard. I'm going to treat myself. And you know what? If that's the case, fair play to them. I wouldn't pay £50 for it, but it's, I suppose, their money. It's crazy money. But you know what? There are some people that love things so much that even a two-hour concert ends up being the memory of a lifetime. And £600 for that level of happiness, it's excessive for many. But do you know what? Do you know what? That's not too bad at all, I suppose, if it brings you joy. But I take your point as well. I'm in your camp, but as I've got older, I understand that different people like different things. Now, Anthony Hunter. Hello, Anthony. You're in Ards in Creasler, and you're 22 today. Happy birthday from all of your mates. Good morning. Could you please wish Pat McColgan, Penny Lane Lifford, a very happy 80th birthday. Happy birthday, Pat. Have a great day. Sending you lots of love on your special day from Maeve Martin and all of us here at Highland Radio and our listeners. Let me see if there's any more requests just for now. No, some more general parking comments, which I'll get to, but we've a lot to get through. In fact, we're going to be speaking to Dr. Joe Kelly, talking history. It was a very special day yesterday for Daniel O'Connell because it was, a significant milestone. We're going to be talking about him, his life, his legacy, that and so much more besides in the next hour and a half or hour and three quarters. All right, so DJ Calvin Harris has divided fans, I read, with a post announcing the birth of his baby boy. That's not the issue here. The Scottish DJ, who's married to Radio 1 host Vic Hope, praised his superhero wife on Instagram in a series of photos taken in Ibiza showing the moment after son Mika's home birth. He also uploaded a shot of Vicky's placenta alongside images appearing to show the organ being dehydrated and turned into pills for consumption. Stacey Stewart is founder of Mama Placenta Remedies and she's from Strabane. Hi, Stacey.
Hey, how's things?
Good. I'm just curious, from someone who sort of works in this space all of the time, when you see articles like this and it's instantly a debate as to whether it's good or, oh, it's terrible and it's yucky, is that frustrating or do you welcome sort of the opportunity to discuss it when it is thrust into the limelight?
I will suppose, coming from my personal experience working with it and seeing the benefits that mums are getting, I can get a bit frustrated because I totally honour it, but I'm also very open for discussion with it. I love educating people and I love being able to have that discussion with people. So yes, it's definitely caused some stir on the internet.
Yeah, now I'm not saying it's the same thing for a second, okay? But like, you know, lots of people listening like to eat a steak, but they don't necessarily want to see, you know, the cow being slaughtered or butchered and the steak being harvested and delivered to them. Do you know what I mean? Do you think it's a little bit about the similar here in that I think what the shock factor is that he showed pictures of things that maybe a lot of people don't need to see, but the processing of the placenta is a means to an end. Do you get the analogy I'm trying to make there?
Totally. But I also do believe that I think it's quite concerning that the backlash that he got was it shows how disconnected that we actually are from birth. It's a very natural process. I think birth has become quite medicalized and sterile, but it was only less than 100 years ago that we were birthing at home. We were birthing exactly how Calvin Harris and his wife experienced. I think we've just became quite detached from that. And I suppose this is why now people are saying that it is maybe offensive, but it's a very normal and natural part of life.
As I say, I don't think it's, like, from my perspective, I don't believe I need to see it. Because, but that's me personal, right? It's very subjective. But I don't think it's offensive. It's there. It's part of nature and it's part of childbirth. And I have seen it in the flesh. Don't get me wrong. I just don't feel I need to. Do you get where I'm coming from? It does. But that doesn't mean that I don't think the work that you do or whatever people choose to do in and of itself is yucky, if that makes sense.
I think as well, though, it's because we don't see it enough. It's not a common enough thing. If we saw this every day, it would be a very normal part of life and we wouldn't find it disgusting. And this is probably one of my biggest movements of doing what I do. And I suppose on my social medias, I'm quite a big advocate of for showing the placenta, but I also have two young children and I want it for their generation to be very normalized, that we won't be looking at it, you know, the way maybe our generation and older generations are looking at it. So
what is the placenta? Just actually, let's break it down, because you know, we talk about stuff and presume everybody knows precisely what it is. So as part of the process, what is the placenta?
Well, the placenta is basically your baby's lifeline. It acts as a multifunctional organ. It grows inside the mummy's womb alongside the baby. It gives all the nutrients from mummy's body through the placenta and to the baby in order to have a healthy pregnancy.
I mean, it's a miracle. I believe, to be honest with you, the whole process is an absolute miracle from inception or conception, for that matter, right through to birth and beyond too, even down to the fact that I think we're one of the only animals, if I could put it like that, that we continue to mature after birth, which really is quite fascinating, and the gap in the top of the head and all that kind of stuff. Right, so what at Mama Placenta Remedies, it's not just placenta either. So I think some people choose to dry and eat it and see the benefits of that. Do you do that as well, or what work do you do with placenta, umbilical cords, etc.?
I try to make it in a much more of a pleasant and discreet manner. You know, each to their own. If you want to eat it with a knife and fork, then absolutely go for it. But for me personally, I think it's a lot more easier ingested through capsules. So I basically dry the placenta out. The capsules are the main part of this process. And it is dried out, pulsified, and placed in the capsules. So it's basically like your own natural multivitamin. I also do offer different remedies. Because the placenta is so high in stem cells and regenerative cells, I do a cosmetic oil, which is really good for the skin. I also do liquid remedies. So kind of like a rescue remedy. Mm. You can add it under your water.
So are you doing that for the mother? So say, for instance, all of the products that you create, the creams, the tablets, whatever it might be, that is always specifically for the mum?
For the mum and some for the baby. So obviously the cosmetic oil is a topical that can be used on the baby as well. There is an essence that I use, which would be quite similar to like a rescue remedy, that can also be safe for baby. It's really good to kind of heal them on like a vibrational level. So that can be added into maybe their bobo or the breast, whatever way they're feeding.
And in terms of umbilical cord keepsakes, what do you do?
So I place it into a heart shape. I then spray it either silver or pink, depending on the sex of the baby. And then I frame it. So it's a very unique, personalised keepsake. I also paint the placenta as well with food colouring. So then this gives, you can probably see it in the back, this gives then a placenta print, so like the tree of life.
Yeah. From the distance, is that the thing that bears some resemblance from my being removed from it to a jellyfish?
Do you know what? That's a very good description. It would, if I was explaining it, it would have quite the same a seal of a jellyfish.
It looks, and as I say, I was reluctant to say that because I didn't want it to sound like I was being in any way detracting. It's beautiful what you've created. And the heart over your shoulder as well, is that one of your works with an umbilical cord?
It's
very personal, isn't it? I mean, you're not going to walk into someone's house and go, oh, what's that? You know, you would have to sort of want to know the story behind it. That's why it's so personal, because it's not in your face if you were to put that on your mantelpiece, for an example.
Well, this is it. I have tried my best to make this as attractive and as acceptable as possible. It's somebody that's going to do this is really going to value the likes of these keepsakes, because you're not going to be able to go into a shop and buy it. You know, this is something so unique, and it also represents that lifeline between baby and...
Well, it's everything. Mommy. It doesn't just represent it. It quite literally is, isn't it? I mean, that umbilical cord from Day Dot, well, not quite literally Day Dot, is the lifeline. That's what drains all the resources out of mum. Leaves them <You're> right. Bantaxed. Do you know what I mean? No. Like, give me a break, baby. I mean, when you think about it, you know, this thing forms inside you and just spends 9 months drawing all of your resources, growing and growing and stretching your body out and adjusting your bones. And it's really just a miracle.
It is. And I think this is another thing as well, that the placenta is probably one of the most disrespected and neglected organs, but it's the only multifunctional organ. Mm. It basically is created within the womb and gives your baby everything. If there's no placenta, there's no human life. And I think this is probably another thing for me, why I'm so passionate about it, because, you know, when you actually are hands-on with this placenta, you will then totally respect and appreciate the job that it's done.
Okay, and... Does something like this conversation, presumably, you know, hopefully it would spark interests, because, you know, if people are into this, if this is what they want to do, why the hell not? Like, you know, as I say, it's probably not for me, but there's lots of things not for me. It's not to do with mums or childbirth of the process. It's just the raw material. It's just to be completely honest with you, Stacey. But that being said, even over the course of our conversation, and I'm looking at the things that you create, certainly the umbilical cord thing, you know, I can see why there's a market there. It's like a picture of a mum and a baby, but it's multiply that by a million. Because it quite literally is the thing that united the two of them.
Yeah, well, thanks for seeing the beauty in that. You know, I always say that as well. This might not be for everybody, and that's okay. But I needed to make this accessible for local mums because, you know, whenever I had done it personally myself, it wasn't really a thing, wasn't talked about. And I also do think that mums deserve the right to feel supported and nourished postpartum, because I do think that it's one of the phases that are, again, so neglected. And a lot of mums don't feel supported after they have a baby and they feel quite abandoned. And, you know, I'm not going to say that this is going to cure everything, but it's an amazing tool to have.
Yeah. Sometimes I think, too, mums can feel a little bit detached from the whole experience.
100%.
You know, because it is kind of so bizarre, not bizarre, but this grounds them in that experience, I suppose, to some extent. And also, too, you know, there's lots of misconceptions out there, like people don't consider the late onset of postnatal depression and stuff. People believe it's just straight away and all this kind of stuff, you know, and moms feeling guilty for not feeling a connection that other moms feel. And I just think this is a process to perhaps help that, or at least, you know, in a cathartic way, make them think about it, because it's all human reactions and we're all human and none of us are perfect to get it right all of the time. All right. Yeah, great. Well done.
Thank you.
I think this is one of those things. It does nobody anyone harm. If people want to do it, they want to do it. And fair play to them. And they're clearly going to be working with a lovely person in yourself, Stacey, if that's a route they want to go down. I presume people can just search Mama Placenta Remedies on socials and they'll get you there, will they?
Yeah, definitely. So my socials is Mama Placenta Remedies. I'm actually just at the finish line of my website as well. So it'll be completed over the next a week or two. So it'll be mamaplacentaremedies.co.uk.
And I will just say, if you don't like purple, you might be in...
You might be in trouble.
You might be in trouble. That's also... But don't let that... All right. Okay, yeah. Everything. I mean, if I was that chest of drawers behind you, I wouldn't sit there too long. It's going to get a spray. It looks lovely. Thanks so much, Stacey.
Thank you.
All right,
so
look
much.
After yourself. Bye bye. All right, that's Stacey Stewart there, founder of Mama Placenta Remedies Strabane. So, what do you think? You've heard? You know, as I say, sometimes are people's personal decisions that aren't harmful, they're not immoral, you know, should they be up for debate, really? Should it be like, so it's like more like, is it for me or is it not for me? I don't know. But speaking to Stacey, she's, you can see she's doing it for all the right reasons, which is. I find that interesting. What do you think? 086 60 25,000. If you're outside the Republic, 00353 86 60 25,000. Give us a call too on 074 91 25,000. A caller says, I took the placenta capsules after my second child and the recovery was amazing compared to the recovery with my first child. No baby blues or postpartum. I just felt amazing and energy levels were through the roof, even coping with the night feeds, etc. I can't recommend them enough. I'm delighted that worked for you. By the way, a mobile phone was found on Kerrykeel Main Street on Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. It contains cash and bank cards. So this was found or lost on Kerrykeel Main Street, Caroline? Found or lost? Found. So we have it? We don't literally have it, but someone has it. The lady has it. Okay, so you will know someone in your life, or it could be you. Did you lose your mobile phone? You might have thought you lost it somewhere else, but you lost it on Kerrykeel Main Street on Wednesday. It contains cash and cards. Give us a call. We'll pass on the number. People load their entire life into their phones. It's bad enough the phone's in there, but then cards and keepsakes and everything in the wallets, and that's fine. It's up to them, but problem is you lose that, you lose everything. We found one, Kerrykeel. 086 60 25,000. Yesterday, the 6th of August, it marked the 250th anniversary of the birth of Daniel O'Connell, the man known as the Liberator or the King of the Beggars. O'Connell is the most commemorated of all Irish historical figures, with 9 cities and towns around the country naming their main streets in his honour, including the capital, where his statue is given pride of place. Pride of place on our show right now is Dr. Joe Kelly, historian and author. Good morning to you, Joe.
My Jean, why you good, Greg? Is the luck day there? Good morning to yourself and to all listening in Highland Radio.
Right, okay. Let's dig into this. Shall we start off with an overview as to why he is so renowned, or shall we start at the beginning and I'll work our way up to that? Like, what was his youth and education, and the Ireland, in fact, that he grew up in, like?
Yeah, well, the Ireland he grew up in is very important. It was a time that the penal laws were in effect, basically anti-Catholic laws. That's the first thing. The second thing was, it was a time when British dominance and colonialism was actually getting to its high point. At this stage, the national schools hadn't been put up in every nearly townland in Ireland. You know, one flag, one king, one country, one language, that whole motto. So 1832 is the establishment, really, of all the national schools. So he's coming at a time when Ireland and the Irish native culture is at a demise. And at the same time, the famine is about to happen in 1847. So, like, when you're thinking he's born in 1775, and there's going to be massive change between that and the end of his life. He actually dies in the year of the famine, 1847. So between that period, a lot of change happens in Ireland. And one of the things is that the emergence of the right of Catholics to vote and become MPs. So in a way, that opened up opportunities for him, and for, because he was educated, he was probably one of the first Catholics to emerge in that new middle class, upper class space for Catholics to move into. Up to then, they were excluded from it. So you talk about his youth. Born in Kerry, 1775, in Derrian, and the house there is a national treasure, and it's run by the government now, and people can go and visit it. And I know there's a lot of events happening over the coming weeks to commemorate 250 years of his anniversary. But it was his. He had two uncles. One that was in France, who was a count, and he was very, very influential on him, towards him. But then his other uncle, Maurice, really took him and cared for him, because he was a wealthy man and owned Derrian Abbey. So he took both Daniel and his younger brother Morris, and seen to it that they were educated. They were sent initially to Cork about 1791, around that period, but then later he sent them to, and paid for them, sent them, well, they went via Liege and into Louvain, but they eventually found their way to the Jesuit college in St. Omer in France, just at the top of France beside Belgium, and he got educated there for some time, and they were so smart and well healed in the sense of education that they decided to move them to a more reputable college, the Benedictine College in Douai. But the problem was the French Revolution was happening, and they feared for these young men's, Irish men's lives. They would have been seen as Catholic. French Revolution wasn't too open to the idea of Catholicism, and they felt maybe that, that these were young priests in the making. So their uncle, who had been there, was very, very worried for them. And so they were sent then to England. And it was there that Daniel finished off really his education and became a barrister.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, the French Revolution disrupted his education and his location. Did it have any other sort of influence on him and what was to come?
Very profound influence on him. A very good question. The fact that he had seen so much bloodshed, and he didn't like the French form of revolution or political change. It was very violent. And people don't maybe realise the French Revolution was a very bloody thing. They estimate about 40,000 people were heads were chopped off. Mm. I mean, that's a concept that's very bloody. And at the same time, about 400,000 to 500,000 people were jailed. Like, when you think of what was there before that, the old Ancien regime, the old system under Louis and the Bastille, the prison, things weren't worse before the revolution as they were after the revolution. It was a reign of terror. Mm-hmm. But look, and there was no given that. They ended up even executing themselves, anybody that they thought might be a monarchist, they executed. So he's seen all that, and I think the bloodshed really got him. And he says, no, this is never the way to go. There's another way. Peaceful protest, which would seep into the whole Irish parliamentary tradition versus the physical force tradition. Mm. And so Daniel O'Connell could be seen to be the man of parliamentary politics, which the nation didn't incidentally follow, because for me personally, and like for Patrick Pearse, the greatest Irish hero, was Wolfe Tone, a Protestant. And Wolfe Tone led a physical force tradition when he failed in his political means, if that makes sense. And maybe history would vindicate Wolfe Tone more than Daniel O'Connell, but that's a matter of opinion. So we maybe talk a wee bit more about that. But Daniel himself became a barrister, came back to Ireland, was very, very successful, was a Catholic barrister, which very few Catholics had that position.
Between his departure for his education and his return in the 1790s, had there been any particular changes in Ireland, the attitude of the Irish under the rule that they were under?
Yeah, that fits a bit of the jigsaw very well there. Yes, the French Revolution had an impact on Ireland insofar as you had likes of Napper Tandy, Lord Fitzgerald, Henry Joy McCracken. The United Irishmen were formed, both Catholic and Protestant, coming together, liberty, equality, fraternity. It was before DEA as we have today, and for the Protestants in particular led this, and Presbyterians, that look, our Catholic brethren are on their knees and they should be equal to us. So that whole philosophy, that whole political ideology had seeped into Ireland, forming of the United Irishmen. And then the rebellion of 1798 took place, also a very bloody thing in many ways, and some terrible things done in the name of the United Irishmen rebellion on both sides. And Wolfe Tone had led that to some degree. In 1796, the Hoche and about 14,000 French soldiers had tried to arrive into Cork, but it was too stormy. They had to go back Christmas Day. So the English knew war was coming. And so in 1798, the revolution took place. It was a failed revolution. At this stage, Daniel O'Connell was in Dublin, was a practicing barrister, and later he would claim that he was supporting the cause of the revolution, but not the physical force tradition. He sat it out at home in Kerry, so to speak.
And in and of itself, I mean, brave or foolhardy. I mean, when you've got your fellow man sort of so moved that they're prepared to put their lives on their line, and he's a barrister sitting in Dublin saying, you know, this is not the way. I'm not against what you're doing, but I'm not for it either. You know, in this day and age, that might be seen as a sort of a controversial stance. Was it controversial then?
Well, look, again, I don't want to go into the history of it, what happened, for example, in Northern Ireland. There's the physical force tradition, and now we're trying a peace process mm-hmm. with no violence. Unfortunately, and I say this as a historian, England doesn't understand
no, peace process. Could a peace process actually ever be achieved without the violence that
exactly.
That's not to justify anything. We can only look at history and sort of say, yeah. Well, you know, it's... I'm just curious about him becoming an MP or entering politics, and maybe it's part of the same story, of course. He is a Catholic. Catholics don't have a vote. I presume Catholics can become MPs, or can they not? So what did he work on in that regard to allow a system whereby he could be elected as an MP?
Well, back to the beginning, we talked about the penal laws, and actually there's an interesting book written by Maureen Wall. She was from Glenswilly. She died in 1972. She's a fabulous book on the penal laws. So up big praise for a Donegal woman. But the penal laws were in place, and they were very much anti-Catholic. He arrives as a barrister to Ireland at that time. He's seeing that there's a lot of discrimination, and he decides, look, this is something I have education, I'm articulate. He was a great motivator and campaigner, so he decides to move into that space and try to do something to get Catholic emancipation. So in the 1820s, he says, right, I'll move into this space, but his political astuteness is something that many, many other political organisations since have followed. His idea of getting people together, he had what they called the penny tax. Each Catholic family would pay a penny rent a month and contribute this into a central fund for Catholic emancipation. He organised meetings.
So when we're talking history with Dr. Joe Kelly, and our focus is Daniel O'Connell, known as the Liberator or the King of Beggars. And I was just asking Joe before the break there, just to explain the phrase Catholic emancipation, because it is critical in our history, and we all would have known it during our years of school, but perhaps we've lost it over time. Because as I say, this is a big part of Mr. O'Connell's story, Joe.
So I was saying with Wolfe Tone and the Catholic Association back in the 1790s, they had gone to visit the king. Wolfe Tone was asked to go with them as a Protestant, addressed the king in England and told him, look, we want Catholic emancipation. We want Catholic rights, equality, that we're emancipated, that we're free, that we're equal. And the king was afraid because of what happened to the French Revolution. He didn't want to have 3 million Catholics at the time in Ireland rise up and lose his own head. So he says, I'll address Parliament and try to get you some rights that you'd be emancipated. But he didn't give us the rights, for example, to become an MP or to vote. And so we could never enter into the civil service. So we never got to the higher echelons of power. And this is what frustrated Wolfe Tone and led him into the revolution, because it didn't go far enough. They were given some freedoms, like owning land and things like that, but not enough when it came to political equality. And so when Daniel O'Connell arrives, and you're talking 1823, he starts off the Catholic Association with the focus of opening up the political means as a route towards advancing the Catholics of Ireland. And so he creates an Irish organisation, a Catholic Association, which becomes massive. Mm. Absolutely massive. The length and breadth. He'd like monster meetings. People came, they gave their penny a week. And the thing is, a penny a month. The thing is, at this stage, he was earning about 6,000 a year with his barrister, you know, law practice and working in the courts and so forth. So once you become an MP, you lose your wage at that stage. There was no MP wage in England. It was usually landed.
So how did he keep bread on the table then? Did he dip into the penny tax?
So that was the penny tax, and that's why you call him the King of the Beggars. And he was looked down by the British here. You're surviving because of the beggars in Ireland giving you a penny a month to keep you going. Mm. And like for the next, I think, 17, 18 years as an MP, when he was elected in Clare, in the by-election in Clare, which he won. He won that election quite well. There was about 900 votes to about 2,050 or something like that there. So he's elected in 1828. This now created a real problem for the English government and the monarchy.
But why did the English government cede that? They must have saw this coming. He had a cohort there ready to vote him in. Like, was there, you know, the pen in one hand and the sword in the other? Why did, knowing what was to come, why would the British cede that control or that freedom to Catholics?
Because, again, the geopolitical system at the time, French Revolution had just happened. Things between France and England weren't great. If you have 3 million Irish Catholics going to rise up, the whole problem with that there. And they said, well, look, it's easier for us to concede this. And it's crazy to think that, you know, that we were excluded at that point. And I think it's still in the law that, like, you can't become the King of England if you're a Catholic, or et cetera, et cetera. So there's that whole, but you can be any other religion but Catholic. That whole anti-Catholic sentiment was there. And the, please, this is not to be anti-Protestant or anti-Presbyterian. That's not, it's just the politics of the time. It's the history of the time. And what, some of the greatest champions of Irish history were people of the Reformed tradition. So just to make that very, very clear. So he succeeded, and they had to change the law, and he's allowed to take up a seat in 1830 in Westminster. So it wasn't just that he became an MP. It meant then, for the first time ever, that Irish Catholics that were fairly well educated could enter into the British civil service. And if you think then what happens after that is a lot of Irish Catholics, particularly Irish people, entered the British civil service. If you think of that picture, Lord Kitchener, your country needs you, and he's pointing during World War One. He was a Kerry man, worked through the civil service. So lots and lots of Irish men, because of O'Connell's opening that door, entered into the whole British system of civil service and rose very, very high in that. So he succeeded in that, and the Catholics were happy. Now they had the right to vote. Now they could have MPs. Now they had political, a means to talk politically as opposed to violence.
Yeah. So how long was he an MP for? What were his primary issues? And Joe, I'm looking at the clock now, and we've got about 7 minutes, right? And I always feel we rush towards the end. So how would his role as an MP be assessed? What were some of his core issues, other than perhaps the obvious, or including the obvious?
Well, he went looking for home rule then after that there. The idea that we would have our own government because of 1798 and Wolfe Tone and the rebellion, the British didn't trust us, took away our government, and they formed this thing called the Act of Union, which is still in this country because six of our counties are still part of that Act of Union. And he then started a campaign to have that repealed. So that was the first repeal, to repeal this union and to have our own government. And again, he had these monster meetings. There was one held in Tara. He had 1 million people attend that. Wow. And this really, really scared the English government. They said, look, this is getting out of hand here. So one of the meetings he had in Clontarf was really 1843. He dies in 1847. 1843, the British government said, no, we're not having this. They ban the meeting. They send in two gunboats, and they say, look, open on the protesters as they saw them. Fire at them if you have to. And Daniel O'Connell, being the kind of man he was, said, look, no, I don't want people hurt or killed. This is going to lead to violence. Mm. So he cancelled the meeting. And really, that was the beginning of his demise, because, again, he wasn't using physical force, but the British were well capable of using it to get their ends. So he didn't succeed in the Home Rule, and it's one of the failures that he had, and it's still to be achieved. But he was very much to the fore when it came to slavery. He was totally anti-slavery. Frederick Engels, who came here to Ireland, who escaped, a coloured man, was a big friend of his, was really impressed with him. And when the ambassador to England from America, came to England, Daniel O'Connell refused to shake his hand. And he said to him very clearly, I will not shake your hand because you're a breeder of slaves. And
And there's a couple of other questions I want to ask, but I want to make sure I get this one to you. What is his legacy then? Is it achieving Catholic emancipation? Is it starting, as soon as you sort of can get into an organisation, and we know how powerful the civil service is and people can rise up the ranks, that it, you know, there might not be a change in the immediate, but change can happen from that. I mean, what is, it's perhaps a tough question to ask you, his legacy? Why is he so celebrated and well thought of then? What is it about his achievement?
Well, firstly, that at that stage when he was there, Catholic Ireland, heads were down. The nation's heads were down. We were bludgeoned to our knees. And if we tried to get off them, we were even bludgeoned even more. And he gave us hope. He gave us a means to get equality and dignity when it came to political means. So in that sense, he was very, very successful. And that political legacy has continued, and particularly the non-violent political legacy. My fear was, and my fear is with him, is like he was very much spoke highly of Queen Victoria. And
was he seen as what some might say at the moment now, a West Brit?
Yes.
And I don't wish to offend anyone with that phrase, but I'm just wondering, was he seen as a West Brit of the time?
Well, maybe not at the time he understood that, but that's the way I would see him, and maybe some other historians.
So what was his then view on something as critical? You wouldn't be a fan?
No, I wouldn't be a fan. In the sense of, I think that the fact that he was in praise of Queen Victoria, what I would see as a famine queen, the fact that he was...
He conceded more than he achieved. Is that your assessment?
I think he achieved a lot, but at some stage, and I agree with Thomas Maher, who was the man behind the tricolour, unfortunately, the only way the English know is you can use a peaceful process, but there has to be that threat always that you will use physical force with the English because it's the only language they understand.
And if that million-man meeting had gone ahead, who's to say how history might have unfolded?
And likewise, where was his silence and his lack of protest for the famine, for example? Maybe that would have been something that we could have avoided had we had our own government and had we been more vocal.
There's a steady downward trend in Irish language use since the famine for many reasons. He obviously was in a position of authority. Was he a big promoter of the Irish language?
Well, that's back to the West Brit. He was happy to be part of the United Kingdom, a devolved government of some sort, that we would still be under the king and under the monarchy. With regards to the Irish language, he didn't care about its demise. In fact, he looked forward to seeing its demise because he seen it as maybe the language of poverty, and the English was more versatile in business and politics. And he was a native Irish speaker. His family was Irish, but he just looked down on the Irish language, didn't use it. And yeah, a lot of cultural nationalists would see him as being someone that had no respect for the Irish culture language.
But he did see Ireland as a separate state, did he? Or did he see Irishness, Irish culture as part of a two-island solution?
I think he liked the whole aristocracy and the upper class, which he was used to, side of the English connection. That nationalist idea was to separate, that we were a separate country with our own culture, our own language, which what I would be of, that, you know, the 1890s, the Culture Revolution, the GAA, you know, 1916, we're our own sovereign, independent people with our own language, our own music, our own dance. That would be the tradition that I would know, and that would be the tradition I think that most Irish people would have understood. But for Daniel O'Connell at his time, it was more he was happy to be part of England and the English aristocratic system and means of government. And for me, fundamentally, as a Republican, and I don't mean this in violence, as a Republican, in essence, what that means is anybody, any man, woman, or child can aspire to the highest office in the land, can go before people for election, can be president of the country. In the English system, it's monarchy. And for me, no, every human being in this country is equal. Mm. And for me, that would be the difficulty I would have with O'Connell, that he had some respect for the monarchy and the system of monarchy and governance. Having said that, he achieved a lot, and I don't want to be critical of him.
But I think those, you know, in this day and age, You can pick out people that would be in political spheres that would be more aligned to his attitude and the attitude towards the British and our future and our language and what's taught in schools and what's not, and those that have different views. Yeah. It's always fascinating, Joe, and we never have enough time, but I really appreciate your time today. Great to see you, by the way, in the flesh last Friday, and we'll chat again really soon. Agus Majin Wai. Slán, bye-bye. Thank you very much. That is Dr. Joe Kelly.